Today's guest, Matt Levin, is an actor and producer, and he... Oh, no, that's not today's guest. Today's guest, Matt Levin, he's a race car driver. That's a different Matt Levin. Matt Levin is a celebrity chef, and he... No, that's a different Matt Levin. Matt Levin is a chief strategy officer for ADP. I don't even know what ADP is. I don't know who these guys are. They all sound far more interesting than today's guest. Just kidding. Matt Levin is the real estate reporter for CalMatters.org, known as the Data and Housing Dude, and he's co-host of the California Housing Crisis podcast called Gimme Shelter, G-I-M-M-E, Gimme Shelter. Welcome back to Radio Real Estate, Matt Levin.
Thanks for having me again, Mark, and thank you for that introduction. I'm trying to be a celebrity chef, maybe one day,
Richard will cut that introduction out, and we'll just send it to you as a snippet so you can send it to all your friends. And had I planned it more in advance, I would have said, welcome to Radio Real Estate, and then you would have said nothing as if you hung up. That would have been even better. But when you do...
Go ahead. What I was going to say is I think that first Matt Levin, the celebrity Matt Levin, he was in Starship Troopers, and he was dominating me on Google for a while. So I don't know if I'll ever achieve that level of fame and fortune.
Well, when you Google Matt Levin, he is the first one that comes up, but you're second.
Oh, hey, how about that?
So, and then the others trail and follow you. So CalMatters.org, you're the first guest of 2020, and Dan Walters, the columnist, CalMatters.org, he was the last guest of 2019. So CalMatters.org is straddling the decades here.
We are supplying the content that your listeners so desperately crave, and we're glad to do it.
Well, thank you. So, I touched on, not last week with Dan Walters, but in the past, about Governor Newsom, and you've written about him wanting to go bold on housing, and then the question is, have he and his lawmakers delivered so far?
So I think even Newsom himself will admit not quite yet. So let's start with the things that he actually has accomplished in concert with the Democratic leadership in the state legislature. Probably the most notable one, which is something that he did say he wanted to do before taking office, was this new anti-rent gouging law that goes into effect. It's in effect. I have to stop saying going into effect. It's in effect as of January 1st. So it's not exactly rent control, but it's kind of like rent control. It caps how much landlords can increase annual rents by about 5% plus inflation. So that's, typically between 6 and 8%. It also provides a host of new protections against evictions. It forces landlords to list a specific reason why they want to evict a tenant. Previously, landlords in California, in most parts of the state, didn't have to do that. And that's kind of the signature tenant protection and anti-gentrification accomplishment that Newsom has been able to make to date. That's the big feather in his housing cap. What's been lacking is a signature housing production bill, so actually building more housing and having the state make it easier for developers to do so.
Okay, so to go back, when you first came on, you had written about, is it Oregon that became the first state to do something significant along these lines?
Yes.
So, and I also want to add that when you said caps it at 5% plus inflation, and then you said 6 to 8%, you meant to say that inflation might be 1 to 3%. So the total rent cap, would be, okay. So you might go five. Yeah, as a matter of fact, a friend of mine saw this bill and decided to raise rents on everyone that has been with him longer than 2-3 years. He might not have, thought of raising their rents, but if he's got a bunch of properties that are under rented, and it would take him several years to catch up, so he decided to raise the rent. So is it a good law? Probably a good law, maybe, but then you have these unintended consequences.
No, your friend is not alone. That was a very, very common reaction among landlords who had, been given some of their tenants, maybe some of them that they've had long-time relationships with, discounts on the rent because they've been good tenants. But the thought was, well, if I have an unexpected expense in the future, if I have to renovate the house or if I have to, you know, replace the water heater or whatever, I'm not going to be able to increase the rent as much as I just want to the level I want because I'm, you know, basically prohibited from doing so by this law.
And, so, or, yes. Or if you want to sell.
What do you mean? Well,
if you want to sell and most of your or a good portion of your units are under market value and you can't bring them up to market value.
That's right. And the tenants, you know, would still have the right to be in those units. So, yeah, that's a very good point.
Now, yeah, but overall, you know, it's tough on tenants. It's tough in California. And I know we didn't plan on talking about this, but I haven't read it completely. But there was an article recently about tenants in common where people are buying into duplexes and fourplexes and maybe occupying one, not owning it fee simple outright, but they're buying it like in a group, tenants in common. So they have partners.
Yeah.
But they end up, of course, then the tenant, I don't know. I'll have to, we'll address that at another time. But it's kind of it's a double-edged sword. You really want to protect tenants from people who, you know, there are some unscrupulous landlords out there, and it's a catch-22. Do you think, is this similar to what Oregon did?
Yeah, it's very similar to what Oregon did. It's actually a tighter rent increase cap. Oregon's was around 10%, and so this California cap is tighter. There's some pretty big exemptions, though, so single-family home rentals that are not owned by corporations are not subject to this cap. And as you probably know and your listeners probably know, single-family home rentals have been increasingly popular since the Great Recession. It's a huge, huge swath of the rental housing market there. So the law isn't going to touch those unless they're owned by corporations, kind of the Blackstones of the world.
And just so people, if they don't know that, there's some of these corporations back, was it going back to 2008, where they just bought hundreds of single-family homes that were in distress, and they made them rentals.
That's right, yeah. And they were very active in California. They pretty much stopped buying new homes in California, ironically, because it's so expensive to do so. They're still pretty active in states like Georgia and Florida. But in some parts of California, they own a pretty significant stock of the single-family home rental housing market. So a lot of people live in homes that are owned and operated by private equity firms and other corporate interests.
Okay, so this my guest Matt Levin, he's the real estate reporter for CalMatters, CalMatters.org. Co-hosts the California Housing Crisis podcast, Gimme Shelter, G-I-M-M-E, the data and housing dude at CalMatters. So this 5% plus inflation is tighter than Oregon, but then again, our rents are probably a lot higher than Oregon, so maybe the dollar amount might be similar.
Yeah, that's a possibility. I think the best way to view this law is this is really intended to prevent some of the more egregious rent increases that you occasionally see in California. So, you know, someone takes over a property and then doubles the rent overnight because they can. Rent increases of 50%, 75%, the stuff that really forces tenants to leave, that's what this law is going to guard against the most, arguably. It remains to be seen how exactly it's going to be enforced. But most rent increases are well below the 5% plus inflation threshold that's set out in this law. And that's why lots of tenant groups are still kind of unhappy with how the scope of the law.
Interesting. Interesting. And your example, someone taking over, that would mean they bought the property and there was still an existing tenant.
Exactly.
Now the new law, and then let's get back to the exemptions. So if you own a single family home and you're not a corporation, it's exempt. It's geared towards and if you own a duplex and you live in one, it's exempt, right?
It's exempt. Yep. Condos also exempt.
Condos treated like a single family as long as it's not owned by a corporation. Wasn't there something thrown in because some people could be a mom and pop that owns one house and rents it out or two? They might own it at, not as a corporation. Well, they might incorporate actually.
They could.
But they're a limited partnership. Did they exclude that or is that in there?
So I'd have to double check on that. It's been a little while since I've written about this. I believe the limited partnerships are excluded. So I think there's also a minimum number of units you have to hold to. So I think it's maybe like 10 units or so. I'd have to double check. So your listeners should be aware that I'm not, 100% accurate on this. But if you're a mom and pop and you own like two or three units, you shouldn't be affected by this law, even if they're single family home.
And I like your comment that for the most part, people aren't going to be affected because most people, if they're going to raise the rent for someone that's been there, they don't want them to leave. And we're going to get into talking a little bit about something else about rents and evictions, and maybe you can dovetail that in. But, so exemptions, cap rate, Oregon. So then going on to Governor Newsom's, he just wanted to build a tremendous amount of houses and finding he can't do that. What's stopping him?
lots of things. So on the campaign trail, Governor Newsom, then candidate Newsom, ran on one of his housing platform pillars was he wanted to help California build 3.5 million units over a decade. That would be an annual rate that California has not seen since they started keeping track of this type of thing. So it was a very, very big, bold goal. His first year in office, there was not a signature bill that would make it easier for developers to build more. Now, even if he got some of those bills, it still remains very doubtful that he would be able to reach that 3.5 million number, which he's going to get kind of crucified on. There was nothing that really materialized that would have eased environmental regulations for developers to build or to force cities to zone for more dense housing. It was talked about. A couple bills tried to do that, but they didn't make it very far in the legislature. And Newsom was kind of standoffish on some of those bills, too, possibly fearing some of the political backlash from cities and homeowners.
Very true. There's so much going on with the fires and the lack of construction. And I guess Matt Levin, CalMatters.org, housing reporter, the data and housing dude. So what's the what's your prediction? What's he going to for Newsom and his attempt? What's he going to be able to accomplish?
I think you are going to see a production bill emerge this year. These are predictions, and if I really actually knew what would happen, I'd be making a lot more money than I currently am, but these are just kind of informed guesses. I think it will force cities to zone for more housing, especially more housing around transit. Probably a reincarnation of Senator Wiener, a Democrat from San Francisco, his bill, the very controversial SB 50. I think it's going to go softer on cities. I think it's going to give them a lot more flexibility and leniency, and probably won't result in as many units being built. But I think that bill, a version of that bill with Newsom support, will probably pass this year.
And just so people know, that SB 50, he was trying to force cities to zone very high density housing within the proximity of transit centers.
That's right. So that's 4 to 5 stories around within a half mile of a major transit stop. So and Newsom never officially endorsed that. He's given these lukewarm indications for it, but if he wants to build more housing, that's one of the more attractive vehicles he has to push for it.
Just as a aside to go back to the first topic of the rent cap increases, a listener texted in, raise your rent 5% every year, maintain your property 5 years, it's 25% gain.
Yep.
I just hope it doesn't force people to just now think that they have to do that every year. I hope it does work, and keep rents down. My guest Matt Levin, CalMatters.org. So speaking of rents, you wrote something in December 2019, and I'll read a little sentence here and let you comment. Rents in San Mateo County have increased nearly 55% since the start of the decade. Two-bedroom in Redwood City, the county seat, now goes for $3,500. Strong demand, influx of high-income tech workers. Vacancies are low, evictions. Yet eviction lawsuits against San Mateo renters from 2010 to 2018 dropped nearly 50%. And then on the state, median rent in California increased 23%. 2011 to 2018, and the number of times California landlords sue their tenants to evict them dropped by nearly 40%. And this was written by my guest, Matt Levin. So what does all this mean?
So I'm excited to talk about this because I don't think this story has gotten enough play yet. I would have bet anything that the higher rents climb, the more you would see official evictions. That it seems like a very intuitive relationship, right? That if the most likely cause of an eviction is someone missing their rent, the higher the rents go, the more often you would see landlords taking their tenants to court to get rid of them. Plus, add in the fact that it's in a really hot rental market, landlords don't have to worry about, well, if I evict this person, am I going to be able to get somebody new in? Right? That's not a problem in San Mateo. There's always going to be somebody who wants an apartment in San Mateo. So going into this story, I just wanted to get at, okay, so what has the eviction trend been over time? And how does that correlate or not with rent increases? And it was the exact opposite of what I expected. It was, no, rent increases, rents have been going up, and eviction filings have been going down, which was very counterintuitive and puzzling to me. And I still think puzzling to both landlords and tenants and academics who study this.
What about if they've been getting the increased rents because there has not been a rent cap as there will be in 2020? So if they're getting high rents, unless someone's not paying, they have no need to evict.
Yeah, I mean that's obviously a possibility. I think the higher the rents go, the more likely it is that the more likely it is that someone won't be able to afford a rent payment. Mm. But you bring up a good point, which is, well, maybe people who are prone to missing rent payments are just getting priced out, and I think that is a lot of it. And it's not just true of California. So in Washington, D.C., super, super hot housing market, super hot rental market. Rents have exploded there. But you've also seen a decline in eviction filings. And one researcher who studied what was going on there basically said, look, like the population that would be vulnerable to evictions or subject to evictions, they've just left. It looks like they've just left. They've gone to lower income parts of Maryland and Virginia because they can't afford Washington, D.C. anymore. And I think that that same type of logic can be applied to the Bay Area, to Los Angeles, to San Diego, a lot of the places in California that have seen big spikes in rent.
This is actually very interesting, and had I known that you were more interested in this topic than the first one, we could have started with that one, because now we're approaching our time limit. Matt Levin, the only true Matt Levin, CalMatters.org, the real estate reporter, data and housing dude. You can find him on the California Housing Crisis podcast, Gimme Shelter, G-I-M-M-E, Gimme Shelter. What'll be interesting, Matt, is through 2020, for you to do these stats again and see with San Mateo County in California now with the rent cap and, you know, what happens with eviction.
Yeah, I think ironically, actually, these official eviction filings might actually go up because landlords could always give out what's called a 60-day notice, a no-cause eviction, and they wouldn't have to file anything with the courts. This new law takes away that possibility. So it might mean landlords have to go to court more often. So in a irony here, the number of official evictions actually might go up after this bill goes into effect.
But if they're going to court, they have to have good reason, right? I mean, you
exactly.
Have to, so it's, you know, which seems, I don't know if anyone would object to that. Hey, Matt Levin, first guest of 2020. Thank you so very much for your time.
It's an honor, and go see Starship Troopers.
To see the other real Matt Levin.
Mm-hmm.
Starship Troopers. Is it on Netflix? Starship Troopers.
I don't know. It came out a long time ago.
Oh, really? Okay. Matt Levin, thank you so much.
Thank you, Mark. Take care.
Okay. Mark Schneidman's Radio Real Estate, RadioRealEstate.com. We'll take a quick break. Homeless people have been in the news. I have a comment on that. And there was a Tesla story about someone getting sued. There's an earnest money deposit scam that is old news, but I want to remind you. And real estate agent trials and tribulations. An agent sent me trials and tribulations. So let's see if we can get to all that in the next segment. Stay tuned. You'll be right back.